and the newspaper gave him an idea. He bought a notebook and wrote an article about the last stand of General Wrangel in Crimea and his evacuation of the last remnants of the White Army from Sevastopol on the 14th of November 1920. The Bolsheviks had executed those they captured by tying their hands and feet and dropping them overboard into the Black Sea. Dmitri had seen many trussed-up corpses in the water, eyes bulging grotesquely as he sailed to Constantinople. When he had finished, he walked to the offices of Rule and sat across a desk while the editor, a man named Burtsev, read his piece.
"You write well,"
Burtsev told him,
"and I have not seen a more compelling account of the final evacuation. I'll pay you 5,000 marks for this story."
That sounded good. "Can I write more for you?" Dmitri asked.
"Sure. If I like your articles, I will pay you. But get yourself a typewriter first."
Dmitri bought a second-hand typewriter and taught himself to type with two fingers. He studied each issue of Rule, as well as its rival paper, Golos Rossi, The Voice of Russia, which was edited by a man who had been Minister of Agriculture in the government of March to October 1917. Burtsev liked Dmitri's work and began to give him commissions, which Dmitri asked him to publish under the family name Yakovlevich so that he would not be identified. Back home, everyone had known him as Malama. He was sent to interview musicians and choreographers, writers and artists, men who had been prominent back in Russia but who struggled to find work in this modern city. Many were living in poverty, having spent any money they managed to bring with them on the journey. Some were working in menial jobs simply to feed their families. Counts served as waiters, princesses as secretaries. Dmitri wrote about the sights of Berlin through the eyes of an émigré, describing the men who dressed as women to work in cabaret shows, the skinny prostitutes with sunken cheeks and haunted eyes, the street sellers with goods that looked too good to be true and broke at first use. Gradually he began to trust Burtsev and asked him if he might write a story about Anna Tchaikovsky. He explained that he had known Anastasia in St. Petersburg. Could the editor perhaps arrange an interview? Burtsev eyed him thoughtfully.
"All my requests for an interview with Miss Tchaikovsky have been refused, but I hear that Princess Irena of Hesse, the sister of Tsarina Alexandra, is arriving in town to visit the girl. Did you ever come across her?"
Dmitri had to say no, he hadn't.
"But can I say you are a family friend?"
Dmitri nodded.
"Certainly." "I will ask if you can talk to her after she has met the girl. There is bound to be a story in that."
Somewhat to Dmitri's surprise, Princess Irena of Hesse agreed to be interviewed by him, asking that he come to her suite at the Adlon, the town's most luxurious hotel. He dressed with care, polishing his shoes and getting a close shave and a haircut in a barber shop. On arrival, Dmitri was kept waiting for over an hour in the sumptuous hotel lobby, with square marble columns and a fountain of water gushing from the trunk of a stone elephant. At last, he was shown up to Princess Irena's suite and found her sitting by a window sipping tea. She was a stout woman in her 50s, her brown hair streaked with grey, and her Germanic features bore a strong resemblance to those of Alexandra. Dmitri was overcome for a moment. This was Tatiana's aunt. He had written to her 2 years earlier asking her to let him know if there was news of the family, but had received no reply.
"Please sit."
She waved him to an armchair and began to speak.
"I assume you wish to hear of my meeting with Miss Tchaikovsky, and I must tell you I am afraid to say she is not Anastasia. There is no resemblance with my niece. The position of the eyes, the bone structure, both are quite wrong."
"When did you last see the Grand Duchesses?"
Dmitri asked, scribbling in his notebook in an attempt to hide his disappointment.
"I admit it's been 9 years, but Alexandra used to send me photographs right up until they were taken into captivity."
She spoke the word with distaste.
"And I am quite certain. This girl is rude and thoughtless, in a way my nieces would never have been. And what's more, she spoke no Russian, not a word."
"How did she explain that?" Dmitri asked.
"Baron von Kleist told me that she suffered some kind of trauma that caused her to lose her memory, and along with it her mother tongue."
"What kind of trauma?" Dmitri reddened, and his pulse quickened.
"I presume he means the murder of the rest of the family."
She took a sip of tea.
"You believe they are dead?"
Dmitri held his breath.
I have it from very credible sources that they all died in the Ipatiev house at the hands of the Red Guards.
Dmitri opened his mouth to speak, but instead a sob burst from his throat. Princess Irina regarded him with surprise as he struggled to regain control.
Did you know them personally? She asked.
He nodded, unable to speak at first, then managed to say,
I was a good friend of Grand Duchess Tatiana.
The princess peered at him through narrowed eyes.
Are you Malama?
He nodded.
Alexandra thought very highly of you.
Dmitri covered his face with his hands.
Come, come, pull yourself together, man.
She rang a bell and asked for a cognac, which was quickly supplied by a uniformed servant. Dmitri took a gulp and felt it burn its way down.
Have you entirely given up hope?
He asked in a strangled voice.
I'm afraid so. If my sister were alive, she would have found a way to get word to me over the last 4 years. She could have asked someone to send a note. None of the family has heard. Nicholas's mother and sister in Denmark, the English family. No one knows any more than I do. We're all furious with Bertie, of course. He could easily have brought them to London back in 1917, but he got cold feet. He's such a coward. He worried about who would support them, how the order of precedence would work. Lord knows what went through his selfish brain. But the upshot is, my sister is dead.
You just assume the worst because there has been no word. You haven't heard this from people in Yekaterinburg, have you?
Dmitri asked, clutching at straws.
I had a letter from the British consul, Sir Thomas Preston. He has spoken to many local people, including Mr. Sokolov, who has escaped overseas and is still preparing the report that he was commissioned to produce by the leader of the White Army. I believe it will be published within a year or so.
She offered Dmitri another cognac, but he shook his head.
Will you please let me know if you should hear any more news of Tatiana or the family?
He begged.
Well, of course.
Her expression was sympathetic.
But you mustn't live in the past. Get on with your future. It's a terrible tragedy, but you are still young, and you will recover. I, on the other hand, will mourn them till the day I die.
Dmitri left the hotel clutching his notebook, headed into the nearest bar, and ordered a vodka. Despite what Princess Irina had said, he vowed that unless someone presented him with absolute proof that Tatiana was dead, he would never give up hope. Never. Chapter 40 Dmitri filed his article about Princess Irina's meeting with Anna Tchaikovsky, and it was published in Rule. A week later, they received a letter from Tsar Nicholas's sister Olga in Denmark, saying that she disagreed with Irina and thought Anna genuinely was her niece Anastasia. The controversy made Dmitri even more determined to meet the girl, but no matter which avenues he tried, he could not find a way through the heavy oak doors of Baron von Kleist's apartment. Dmitri spent his days writing articles and his evenings in the cafes of Charlottenburg, drinking with crowds of Russian émigrés. They moaned to each other about Berlin, calling it a materialistic city where everything was for sale, with gaudy advertising all around and prostitutes openly hustling passers-by on every street corner. Usually one or other of his drinking companions would end up in tears of homesickness for Mother Russia once they were a few bottles down. One evening, Dmitri was with a group who became rowdy and started smashing glasses on the floor, whereupon the doorman escorted them off the premises. Dmitri's comrades headed straight into a neighbouring bar, but he sat on the grass in the middle of Praga Platz to let the cold night air clear his head. A girl who had been working in the cafe came running across to him.
"You left your notebook,"
she said in Russian. It had all his notes from an interview that day, and he was relieved not to have lost it.
"Thank you. You've saved my life,"
he said melodramatically.
"I've seen you here before, haven't I? My name is Rosa."
She held out her hand. As he shook hands with her, he noticed she had a very full bosom for someone so petite, and that she had pretty eyes and short dark hair.
"You've got a boy's haircut," he remarked.
He hadn't noticed her when she brought their drinks to the table, but close up she was definitely attractive. She laughed.
"I have it cut in a barber's shop. It's cheaper than a women's hairdresser. Are you a writer?
Her Russian was fluent, but she had a German accent, which made it sound unfamiliar.
I write articles for RUL, he said, then added, I'm also working on a novel.
He had no idea why he said this, except that every white Russian in Berlin seemed to be writing a novel, and it sounded romantic.
What's your novel about?
She asked, sitting on the grass beside him.
It's about love, of course. A great love affair that spans decades and continents, but is ultimately doomed to unhappiness.
He was in a maudlin state, thinking of Tatiana.
But why can it not have a happy ending? Because all love affairs end unhappily, he said, like all wars.
He wasn't drunk enough because depression was creeping up on him.
Could you fetch another bottle of wine from your bar? I've got the money.
No,
she said firmly.
But my shift is finished, so I will get my coat and take you home. Where do you live?
Dmitri considered. Suddenly it seemed a compelling idea to take comfort in a woman's arms, to nestle his head against that full bosom and breathe in a female scent. He had not made love to another woman since meeting Tatiana back in 1914, and he felt guilty even thinking about it. But all the same, it was tempting. He let Rosa help him to his feet and lead him the short distance to his apartment, with her arm linked through his. She helped when he fumbled with his keys, then steadied him on the way up the stairs. Will I be capable of sex? Dmitri wondered, shortly before he passed out. When Dmitri woke the next morning, he turned his head to see if Rosa was beside him. She wasn't, but the bed had been neatly made, with the sheets tucked in, and he was lying beneath the covers in his underwear. Normally he did not make the bed from one day to the next, simply slipping into the hollow his body had formed the night before. And the other odd thing was that he could not remember getting undressed. Had Rosa taken his clothes off? He glanced round the room and saw them neatly folded over the back of a chair. On the bedside table there was a glass of water and a bottle of Bayer aspirin powder. The sight irritated him, but he took a sip of water all the same, his mouth dry as cardboard and his breath rancid. He heaved himself out of bed, pulled on a dressing gown, and went through to the tiny kitchen alcove. He had left the sink overflowing with dirty dishes, but now they were washed and stacked away, and the surfaces sparkled. His irritation grew. In the sitting room, everything was neat and tidy, but there was no sign of the girl. How dare she come into his home and clean it without permission? He put on a pot of coffee, then went to the bathroom to wash and shave. She hadn't cleaned there. The bath had a greasy grey tide line, while the sink was grimy with bristles. He was still annoyed, and as he performed his ablutions, he considered charging round to the cafe to remonstrate with Rosa for cleaning up. It was only when he planned the words he would use that he realized how foolish it would sound, and began to chuckle. His notebook was sitting on the table next to the typewriter. Thank goodness it hadn't got lost. And he sat down with a cup of coffee to read through his notes from the previous day. Suddenly he remembered telling Rosa that he was writing a novel. Why not? He had recently started reading novels again, borrowing them from Rodina's bookshop, which stocked Russian-language books. Many works by émigrés were self-indulgent laments, with little plot or characterization. He was sure he could do better. He went out to the local bakery to buy some warm pastries, then came back to eat them with another cup of coffee, and he began to jot down ideas for his novel. A boy and a girl meet in their teens and fall in love, but are torn apart by civil war when their families are sent to opposite ends of Russia. Then he would write of the boy's long search to find her again. Tatiana was in his head every moment, and he decided to try and define the effects of love on body and soul. He found the first scene was clear in his mind. The boy, whom he would call Mikhail, watches the girl, Valerina, after his beloved sister, falling off her bike and trying desperately not to cry at the pain of grazed hands and knees. At that moment, Mikhail feels the beginnings of the empathy, basically an insight into another person's emotions, the first step that will lead to love. He began to write, and the words flowed from his pen, bringing a sense of tranquility. Two nights later, he went back to the cafe where Rosa worked, and asked if she would like to have dinner with him on her night off.
"Well, of course I would," she replied,
rolling her eyes as if she couldn't understand what had taken him so long. Chapter 41 Dmitri had only seen Rosa in her tight black-and-white waitress's uniform, so he was somewhat taken aback when she met him for their dinner date, wearing her own rather eccentric clothes. Her frock of a yellow and purple pattern was a couple of sizes too large, as if she had borrowed it from her grandmother's wardrobe, then belted it round the hips so it didn't fall down. She wore strings of multicoloured beads round her neck and multiple bracelets that clattered as she moved her arm, while on her head there was a cloche hat with a knitted purple flower attached. When he looked closely, he saw there was a knitted bee inside the flower. It was like a parody of the flapper style worn in the more expensive clubs of Charlottenburg, but somehow it worked. While they talked, her dress slipped down to reveal the creamy flesh of her shoulder, and she ignored it for a while before pulling it up with a wink. They ate in a medium-priced restaurant, and he ordered steak for them both, followed by a rather good Apfeltort. Rosa asked about his life in Russia, but he didn't feel like talking about that, so instead he questioned her about her own background. Born in the countryside, she said she had always longed to swap the sound of cows outside her bedroom window for the traffic and bustle of the city. She moved to Berlin when she was 18 and shared a tiny apartment with three other girls, one of whom was her cousin, a dancer. She was now 21 and she loved dancing, eating good food, and meeting new people. Especially people. "Do you enjoy waitressing?" Dmitri asked. She wrinkled her nose. "For now. The tips are good, but some customers are rude. They look down on me for the job I do without knowing anything about me. I could be a ballerina or a scientist, an artist or a pearl diver, but they don't see past the uniform to my magnificent brain and sparkling personality." She flung her arms out dramatically like a compere at a cabaret announcing the star guest. Dmitri laughed. "Tell me then, what are you?" She cocked her head to one side and thought before answering. "I don't entirely know yet, but I like looking after people. I want to have dozens of babies one day. Hundreds of them." "I sincerely hope you achieve your ambition." "Well, at least I can have fun trying," she twinkled. Dmitri marveled at the freedom of this woman's life, so unlike those of women in Russia. She could do what she wanted, say what she felt without fear of repression. It was refreshing. After dinner, they strolled through Charlottenburg, which she told him Germans were now calling Charlottengrad because of the high percentage of Russian immigrants. "How did you learn to speak such fluent Russian?" Dmitri asked, because that was the language they conversed in, although she sometimes switched to English mid-sentence if she didn't know a word. "I picked it up as I went along. You'll find I'm very chatty. Some cruel folks say it's hard to shut me up." "Would you like to come back to my apartment?" he asked. "That sounds marvelous," she replied in English, rolling her R with a broad smile. Soon after climbing the stairs, they were undressing each other and jumping into Dmitri's bed. Rosa made love enthusiastically and expertly, rolling him over onto his back so she could sit on top. It was clear she was not a virgin, and afterwards he rather ungallantly asked about her previous lovers. "There was just one before you," she said. "He was also Russian. I liked him, but he disappeared one day, and several weeks later I got a postcard from Paris. He said he thought Bolshevik spies were following him and had to flee. I don't know if it was true or not." "You didn't want to join him in Paris?" "He didn't ask," she said in a small voice, and Dmitri felt compassion for her. "I apologize on behalf of my countrymen," he said. "He was a fool to lose you." She turned and kissed him on the mouth, an urgent kiss that moved him deep down inside. The next day, while he worked on his novel, Rosa went to the market and bought a cheap cut of meat and some vegetables, from which she produced a delicious pot of stew. They ate bowls of it for lunch, along with big chunks of bread, and before leaving to start her shift in the cafe, she even cleaned his bathroom. She hummed as she worked, so Dmitri didn't feel the need to stop her. Or at least when the thought passed through his mind, he was able to overrule it.
"Will I see you later?" she asked as she pulled on her coat.
A little warning bell rang in Dmitri's head. He didn't want to feel an obligation towards her. But at the same time, she was a cheerful soul, and it was pleasant having her around. Besides, he could hardly say no after all she had done for him. "I'll pick you up after your shift," he said, kissing her goodbye. As soon as the door shut, he went back to his novel. Before long, Dmitri and Rosa slipped into a pattern of sleeping together 3 or 4 evenings a week. On her night off, she liked to drag him along to the El Dorado nightclub, which had opened in Charlottenburg earlier that year. Her cousin worked there, so they could usually secure a good table from which to watch the transvestite dancers, the striptease artists, and the comedy burlesque acts. Rosa often got up to dance on the tiny dance floor, and Dmitri laughed to watch her in her oversized frocks, like a little girl playing at being grown up. She mimicked movie stars with flirtatious flicks of her hemline, her mouth rounded in pretend shock at her own audacity. Berlin couldn't have been less like the high society of St. Petersburg, with its unbreakable rules and strict formality. Dmitri didn't think he had ever seen a homosexual man in Russia. Perhaps they did not exist. Perhaps it was not in the national character. But here they were everywhere. He felt a little uncomfortable around them, not sure how to talk to them so that they would know that he wasn't available. He'd often slip his arm around Rosa's waist to be doubly sure they got the message. Sometimes, after making love with Rosa, Dmitri lay awake, feeling guilty about his affair. He was a married man. He should not be in bed with another woman. How could he be happy when his wife was missing? But there was no question that if Tatiana appeared one day, he would quietly explain the situation to Rosa and beg her forgiveness for leading her on. He would have no hesitation in choosing between them. Dmitri often asked Burtsev, his editor, if there was any further news of Anna Tchaikovsky. It seemed she had left Baron von Kleist's apartment sometime in the autumn and returned to hospital with a range of ailments that required medical treatment. She was not staying at the Dalldorf Asylum this time, but at the Westend Hospital in Charlottenburg, not far from his apartment. One evening, he asked Rosa if she ever heard any customers in the cafe talking about her, and straight away she replied, "No, but my friend Clara is a nurse at Westend. She tells me Anna Tchaikovsky is very timid and barely talks to anyone. She has a badly infected arm." Dmitri stared at her, eyes wide with excitement. "Do you think your friend would be able to get me into the hospital to see her? Can you ask?" Rosa seemed surprised at the intensity with which he spoke. "Yes, of course. I'll call on her tomorrow if it means so much to you." "Thank you." He squeezed her hand tighter than he had meant to, and she flinched.
Chapter 42. Berlin, January 1923. It transpired that Rosa's friend Clara was unwilling to help Dmitri sneak into the hospital to spy on their famous patient.
"It could cost her her job," Rosa explained.
"I'll make sure it doesn't. Please, you have to convince her."
Dmitri was determined.
"Won't you try again?"
When Clara once more refused to help, Dmitri grew angry and threw his notebook to the floor.
"She's not much of a friend, is she? Why won't she do as you ask?"
Rosa looked at him closely.
"This isn't just about writing a story for Rule, is it? Did you know Grand Duchess Anastasia in Russia?"
Dmitri couldn't talk about that part of his life.
"Slightly,"
he said, turning away.
"Only slightly."
After that, Rosa somehow succeeded in persuading Clara. Dmitri didn't ask how. It was arranged that they would meet her one lunchtime at a side door of the huge, sprawling hospital with its red-tiled roofs and towering spires. She would give him the overalls of an orderly, along with a broom and dustpan, and direct him to the ward. Once there, he could go in and sweep round the bed in Anna Tchaikovsky's private room, but if she panicked and started to scream, as she sometimes did at the sight of strangers, he must pretend he let himself in and must not mention Clara's name. As they walked to the hospital, Rosa chatted about everyday matters. Her boss's secret girlfriend, a new recipe for meatloaf. And for once her conversation annoyed him, interrupting the flow of his thoughts. It was almost 5 years since he had seen Anastasia, but he was positive he would know her straight away, even if those chubby girlish cheeks had thinned out and the long curly locks had been trimmed. People have an essence, something in the eyes that makes them recognizable. What if it was her? He would feel compelled to ask what had happened to the rest of the family, to Tatiana. As if reading his mind, Rosa remarked,
"Seemingly she speaks no Russian and very little English. Do you think you can converse with her in German? You've improved a lot."
"I thought Clara didn't want me to speak to her."
"But if it's her, I'm sure you will."
Rosa seemed sad, but he didn't have time to wonder why before they reached the hospital building and followed Clara's directions down a side alley to the workers' entrance. She appeared at the appointed time carrying an overall and broom. Dmitri thanked her.
"I'll wait here,"
Rosa promised as he hurried inside. He felt strangely calm once he was in the hospital, about to meet the woman for whom he had left Constantinople and travelled to Berlin. Clara pointed down a corridor and told him to take the first staircase on the left, climb to the second floor, then go into the fourth room on the right. He thanked her and walked off, broom and dustpan in hand. He hesitated outside the door of the private room, gathering his nerve, then pushed it open and saw a young female patient lying back on the pillows, eyes closed. He did not look at her directly at first, but when he did, his heart leapt. It could be her. It might be. His face burned. He swept the other side of the room first, around the window with its view across the rooftops of the city. When he turned to sweep near the bed, Anna Tchaikovsky opened her eyes suddenly. Her hair was short and brown, her eyes blue, and she had a wide mouth and a long nose. The similarity was definitely there. His heart beat faster.
"May I sweep under your bed, ma'am?"
he asked in German, and she nodded her consent.
"Do I know you?"
she wondered, watching him work.
"Perhaps,"
he replied. "Do you think you do?" She sighed.
"Oh, I can't tell. I see so many people from the past and have no memory of them. You are Russian, are you not? You look Russian."
"Yes, I am. There are many of us in Berlin."
"Did you know my family? The Romanovs, I mean."
Her voice was deeper than Anastasia's, but that could have happened with age.
"I did, and was horrified to read speculation that they were killed. But perhaps if you have escaped, then some of the others might too."
This was the moment. This was when he would know. He held his breath.
"I don't think so,"
she said.
"They were all butchered. Brutally butchered. Apart from me."
"So you remember a little bit now. I heard you had forgotten."
"I remember flashes of scenes, people's faces, but nothing links up. It's all a muddle."
She swept a hand across her forehead. Her other arm was heavily bandaged. "And Tatiana? Was she killed?"
"Yes. I watched Tatiana die."
Dmitri flinched and stopped sweeping, for a moment unable to breathe.
"When did she return to the Ipatiev house?" he asked. "The night before she was killed?"
There was a moment's hesitation before Anna answered, puzzled.
"But she never left. None of us were able to leave after we arrived there in the spring. We couldn't even go to church."
Blood rushed to Dmitri's brain, making him giddy.
This was not Anastasia, but an imposter.
Just to be sure, he asked, "What happened to Yelena, the cleaning girl?"
"I don't know who you're talking about. Who are you, anyway? Why are you here?"
She grew alarmed.
"I'm a cleaner, don't worry. I have finished my work. I'll leave you now."
He hurried to the door and out into the corridor, where he leaned against a wall to breathe deeply. Were she genuinely Anastasia, she would remember that one of the cleaning girls took her sister's place for the second-to-last night they were in the Ipatiev house. He felt angry with Anna Tchaikovsky for pretending, but his anger didn't last long. She was a poor creature, very nervous and hesitant, and clearly mentally ill. Most of all, he felt a huge sense of deflation. Had it been Anastasia, he might have learned what happened during the family's last 24 hours, might even have learned what became of Tatiana. But now he was back at the start,
with no leads at all. He had come to Berlin for nothing. Although he supposed that wasn't entirely true. The journey had been valuable, in that it made him start writing, and he found a sense of peace when engrossed in his novel that had been lacking from his life in Constantinople. Once he recovered his composure, he retraced his steps downstairs to the side entrance, slipped off the overalls, and left them in a corner with the broom. He pushed open the door to step outside, and somehow the sight of faithful Rosa waiting for him in her red wool coat and man's grey trilby hat brought tears to his eyes. If only he could love her the way she deserved to be loved.
"Was it her?"
Rosa asked, rubbing her hands and stamping her feet against the penetrating cold. He shook his head and wiped his eyes with the back of his hand.
"Now will you tell me what this is all about?"
she asked.
"I think you owe me, don't you?"
Dmitri and Rosa went to the nearest cafe and sat at a corner table. They ordered hot chocolates and a slice of black forest cake with whipped cream to share. Outside it was starting to snow, light flurries drifting past the window making passers-by turn up their collars and pull down the brims of their hats. Rosa was uncharacteristically silent, blowing on her hot chocolate to cool it while waiting for him to talk. "I used to be in the Imperial Guard in St. Petersburg," he told her, "and I fell in love with Tatiana, the second eldest of the Tsar's daughters. She also fell in love with me, and in 1916 we were secretly married." Rosa gasped, and her eyes widened with shock. "You understand why I haven't told you this before. It could have made me a target for Bolshevik spies. On paper, the marriage puts me in line for the Russian throne, so they would be keen to eliminate me if they knew."
"Do you want the Russian throne?"
she asked, clearly flabbergasted.
"No, of course not. But I desperately want to find out what has happened to Tatiana, and that's why I was so keen to meet Anna Tchaikovsky." "But your wife must be dead," Rosa said. "How could she possibly have lived? Where could she be? I understand it is hard to give up hope, but surely there can be none."
Dmitri felt cross with her. "Actually, I have reason to hope. She was not in the Ipatiev house the night before the family disappeared." He explained what had happened, and Rosa listened carefully.
"But if she were alive, she would have contacted her family by now. Princess Irina, Grand Duchess Olga. She would have tried to find you."
Dmitri spoke tetchily.
"Anything could have happened. You don't understand how dangerous the Bolsheviks are, even overseas. Just 2 weeks ago, a distant cousin of the Romanovs was shot dead in his Paris apartment."
Rosa sighed. The cake lay untouched between them.
"So you are telling me that you will wait until you find out what happened to Tatiana before you marry again? Did you not think I had a right to know this, since we have been lovers for 4 months, nearly five?"
"Is it that long?" Dmitri asked, then instantly realized from her hurt expression that it had been the wrong thing to say.
"I only meant that it feels so fresh and new. I like being with you, Rosa. We have fun. But you are married. Thank you for letting me know at last."
On the way home, he could tell she was trying to shake off her bad mood, telling him some anecdote about the brother of a girl at the cafe, but he wasn't listening. He was bitterly disappointed that Anna Tchaikovsky was not Anastasia. It meant he had hit another dead end. That night, after they made love, Rosa whispered,
"I love you."
Dmitri froze, unable to say it back, even casually. Instead, he tilted her face to his and kissed her tenderly, hoping that would do. Afterwards, he lay awake, thinking of Tatiana, her voice, her smile, the way she moved. She still filled his heart so completely there was no room to love anyone else. He didn't want to lose Rosa, who brought joy and laughter and womanly comfort, but it would be a lie to tell her he loved her.
Chapter 43. Lake Akanabi, New York State, end of September 2016. In the days after reading Tom's letter, Kitty tipped into a depression. She could feel it happening, and didn't try to resist, because it felt as though it had been brewing for a while. Besides, It matched the climate. Although the days were still warm, she could sense the end of summer, with a sharp breeze in the evening and random leaves turning golden brown and floating down from the trees. It made her realize that her days there were running out, with just over 2 weeks left before her flight home. The contents of Tom's letter swirled around her head as she worked in the garden she had created. Would it have helped if she had let him comfort her after her parents died? She had chosen the only route that felt manageable, keeping busy. The enormity of the loss had simply been too much to bear. Now her parents filled her thoughts as she dug the soil. Her dad had been a quiet, undemonstrative man, with a character that was steady and true. She loved the fact that he had treated her the way he would have treated a son, sending her up ladders to help with the guttering, teaching her carpentry skills, assuming she could change a plug from an early age. She could tell when he was proud of her by a secret smile and a faraway look in his eyes. Although they seldom talked about emotions, she always felt he was her ally. A memory came to her of a night before a school exam, when she had a classic full-scale panic attack that made her tremble and retch convulsively. Her dad had taken her by the hand and led her out to the back garden, where he set out two deck chairs. They sat side by side in the darkness, while he identified the constellations above them. Ursa Major and Minor, Andromeda and Pegasus, until she was calm enough to go to sleep. Her relationship with her mum had been far more volatile. All the pressure she put on Kitty to succeed had meant they were not close during the difficult teenage years. Her mum fussed too much over Kitty's health, her finances, and her fashion choices, as well as her exam results. After she left home, there were times when Kitty let the answer machine pick up any calls because she couldn't face her mother's critical onslaught. Even now, looking back, she felt cross about the pressure she had been under, although she recognized it had been motivated by love. "You needed pushing," she heard her mother saying. "You and your dad. If you had it your way, you'd both sit around all day whittling pieces of wood." She'd been critical of Kitty's teenage boyfriends, but took to Tom straight away, even though he was a struggling musician, which wasn't her idea of a respectable career. She let him tease her about her exacting standards in a way that no one else got away with. "Now, Elizabeth," he'd smile, "are you sure that flower arrangement is perfectly symmetrical? Shouldn't the salt cellar be a few millimetres to the left?" Tom was the only person able to make her laugh at herself. Kitty remembered the pretty sound of her laugh. "What would you advise me to do, Mum?" she asked in her head. And knew straight away that her mother would tell her to go back to Tom and work things out. "I won't have a divorcee in my family," she would have said. "The shame of it!" They'd only been in their 50s when they died, after a coach careered through the central reservation of a Spanish motorway. A postcard had arrived a week later, full of holiday joie de vivre, her dad writing about his guilt when picking a lobster from the tank in a restaurant, and her mum commenting that its colour, when cooked, matched her dad's sunburn. By that time, Tom was helping her to organise their funeral. All those awful decisions to be made. "What clothes do you want to wear to be cremated, Mum?" Tom, bless him, had taken care of the legalities of the estate, of clearing and selling the family home where Kitty had grown up, while she... what exactly had she done? She couldn't remember now, except that as soon as the money came through, she bought the Tottenham house and launched herself into a year of keeping busy. She found herself chatting to her parents in her head while she worked on the cabin. Sometimes she even spoke out loud. "Why did no one tell me about Dimitri, Mum? Did you ever meet your grandfather? Did Marta tell you about him? What was he like?" There was no one to answer that now. Death was too final. She'd missed her chance. Kitty had run out of plants, so she made a trip to the garden centre for more, and on the way back, she stopped at the vacation park coffee house. Tom knew she had received his parcel and would be waiting for a reply, but she wasn't sure what to say. Perhaps the words would come to her. She charged her laptop, but instead of going straight to her email folder, she found herself looking up Karen Bayliss on Facebook. The only reason she hadn't done so before was because she hadn't known the surname, and now she did. She was astounded. The image on Tom's phone hadn't been very clear, but she realised Karen looked for all the world like an inflatable sex doll. Her profile picture showed huge breasts on display, in a low-cut top, like plump cuts on a butcher's slab. Brown hair, with blonde tiger stripes painted through it. Inches-long black eyelashes, swollen lips, and a fake tan the colour of butterscotch. It was impossible to think of a physical type less like her. What had he been thinking of? Kitty almost felt like sending him a sarcastic email about his lack of taste, but that wasn't the way forward. She glanced through her inbox and replied to a few friends. There was a message from Random House in New York apologizing for the delay in answering her query due to staff holidays. Kitty remembered that Dimitri's Berlin publisher was a company called Slovo. The name appeared on the copyright page of his books. She googled Slovo and found they had been started in Berlin in 1920 by a man named Joseph Gessin, and that they also published Pushkin, Tolstoy, and Nabokov, as well as producing a Russian-language newspaper for émigrés known as RUL. There had recently been an exhibition about immigrant publishers in Berlin, and she was able to find Dimitri's name in a list of authors, along with a short biography saying that he was a journalist for RUL. How strange that both she and her great-grandfather had the same profession. Perhaps it was in their genes. It took some searching, but Kitty eventually found an article by Dimitri in the RUL archives. It was in Russian, but she used Google Translate and was able to make out from the stilted text that Dimitri had interviewed Princess Irena of Hesse shortly after she went to visit a girl called Anna Tchaikovsky, who was claiming to be Grand Duchess Anastasia. This puzzled Kitty. The article was written in 1923, and the Romanovs had been murdered in 1918. How could an imposter hope to deceive family members only 5 years later? She googled Anna Tchaikovsky next, and found several long articles about her. It seemed the remaining Romanov family had been split into two camps, with some believing the claimant, while others were adamant she was not Anastasia. In photos, she looked plausibly similar. Of course, Kitty remembered. In 1923, the world didn't yet know about the fate of the Romanovs. It was the following year when White Army investigator Nicholas Sokolov published his report, concluding that the family had all been killed in the Epitiev house. He had found witnesses who told of the blood-soaked basement, scarred by bullet holes and frenzied knife thrusts, and had taken photographs of personal possessions found in a burnt-out mine shaft. Even after that, rumours persisted that one or more of the children had escaped. Anna Tchaikovsky maintained her story, and it led to lawsuits that were only settled after her death, when a DNA sample found she had been a Polish factory worker called Franziska Szanskowska. Why did so many people believe in her? Kitty imagined it was because the truth, that all the royal children were slaughtered, was too horrific to contemplate. In his article, Dimitri seemed sure that Anna Tchaikovsky was not Anastasia, and he speculated on the reasons why the poor woman lingering in a Berlin hospital bed might keep up such a bizarre pretense. He suggested that maybe something terrible had happened in her previous life, and she was sublimating the memory by assuming a new identity. The psyche was so deep and mysterious that he guessed she had come to believe the story herself. "People can persuade themselves of virtually anything," he wrote, "as we have learned through the writings of Messrs. Freud and Jung." Kitty's thoughts turned to Tom again. Would she have been more upset if he had chosen a mistress who resembled her? Wouldn't that mean he was trying to replace her? What was he doing choosing someone who clearly offered sex on a plate? The word obvious came into her head. The counsellor had told Tom he wanted to be found out when he left his phone in the hall. He chose someone who looked like an obvious sex object. He was trying to get Kitty's attention, to make her sit up and take notice. Well, she thought, he had certainly done that. If she emailed him now, sarcasm would almost certainly slip into her tone. What did other couples do in their position? Have a huge fight to clear the air? Arguing and confrontation had never been her style. Perhaps it was something to do with being an only child. She hated to feel out of control, but at the same time, she realized that bottling things up could make them worse. It was her avoidance of emotional issues Tom was talking about in his letter. Maybe if she was able to tell him how she felt about Karen Bayliss, they could start an honest conversation. But she couldn't think how to begin. "Dear Tom, how could you?" That wasn't her style. She'd leave it for another day, when she had decided on the words. That evening, she looked through Dimitri's novels. The first one, published in 1924, had no dedication, but Exile was for Nicholas, and The Boot That Kicked was for Marta, her grandmother. The last two novels, published in America in the 40s, were for Rosa, but in the acknowledgements pages, he thanked Alfred A. Knopf for having faith in him. He thanked his family for their support, and he thanked Irena Markova, his English translator, for her talent. She flicked back to his first novel and thought what a shame that Irena Markova had not translated that one, because it was such a clunky read. Even in a poor translation, the description of first love was overpowering. Dimitri described the sense of completion that comes from having another brain to bounce ideas off, the secret joy of watching another person across a crowded room and knowing exactly what they are thinking at that precise moment, the miracle of a partner who knows you better than you know yourself. One phrase stuck in her mind, Mikhail's talk of his great fondness for Valerina's intimate imperfections. A tiny mole behind her ear, the way she nibbled the corners of her nails when nervous. An image sprang into Kitty's head of Tom trying to hide the bulge at his waistline by pulling his shirt out an inch or two in a blouson style. He'd suck in his belly while examining the effect in the mirror, unaware she was watching. That made her smile. And then she thought of him singing along to 90s pop songs in an off-key falsetto. Her face broke into a grin. There was no doubt she still loved him. Could they save their marriage? With all her heart, she hoped so.
Chapter 44 Berlin, 1924. When Dimitri first moved to Berlin, it had been a cheap city in which to live. But in 1923, prices began to rise stratospherically as hyperinflation was triggered by the government's decision to print more money. A loaf of bread that had cost 163 marks in 1922 was selling for 200 million marks by November 1923, and wages could not keep pace. Dimitri was forced to ask his family in Constantinople to wire money, which he found humiliating. He would have left Germany entirely, but for the fact that a Berlin publishing company had offered to publish his novel. Burtsev, the editor of Ruhl, had passed his manuscript to the Slovo Publishing House, which was part of the same company. Much to Dimitri's astonishment, it was accepted, and in spring 1924, Interminable Love was published to moderate acclaim. Dimitri was invited to give a reading at Rodina's bookshop, and many Russian émigré papers ran favourable reviews. A friend of the owner of Rodina's asked for permission to translate it into German, and another woman wrote asking if she might do the English translation. Dimitri was reluctant, because he felt it was a quintessentially Russian novel that would be impossible to translate, but he needed the money, and so he agreed. Throughout, he felt ambivalent about the publishing process. He found it embarrassing to have the intimate feelings of his characters, which were in essence his own, exposed to the public. He would have preferred to remain anonymous, but Rosa was overjoyed by his success. She recommended his novel to all the customers in her café, and often wandered into bookshops to move it to a more prominent position. When the German edition of Interminable Love was published, he gave her a copy, but if she read it, she never told him. Putting himself in her position, it would be hard to read about his love for another woman. She must guess it was about Tatiana. Perhaps she decided not to read it after all, but still she helped promote it, and most people who knew them assumed it was about Rosa. They began to be invited to literary salons, and Rosa was intellectually out of her depth in the conversations about art and literature, but everyone liked her for her open, friendly nature and admired her offbeat dress sense.
She bought her clothes in flea markets and deliberately chose mismatching colours, such as lime green and purple, hot pink and orange, when throwing outfits together. Dmitri described her look as an explosion in a garment factory. There was no artifice about her, and that was refreshing in a town where so many people were hiding their true natures, especially amongst the Russian community. Soon Rosa had many more friends in Berlin's literary set than Dmitri did, and she invited them back to their apartment to drink schnapps and listen to poetry being read aloud. He watched her sometimes, and marvelled at her ability to remember the names of friends' children and the fine details of their lives. She complimented people on their writing and laughed at their witticisms, making them feel good about themselves. Perhaps that was the key to her social success. At a salon one evening in summer 1924, Burtsev told Dmitri that the Yekaterinburg prosecutor, Nicholas Sokolov, had finally published his report into the fate of the Romanovs.
"It seems Sokolov escaped the Red Army by fleeing through Siberia with a box of the items he found in the Yekaterinburg mine shaft," the editor explained. "During the intervening years, he has interviewed émigrés and Romanov family members, making copious notes until he felt ready to present his findings to the world."
Dmitri's hands were shaking. He put his glass on a nearby piano.
"And his conclusion, no doubt, is that they all perished.
That's his opinion.
And yet, I do not believe he has found the bodies, has he?"
"He makes the rather grisly claim that they were hacked to pieces, dissolved in sulfuric acid, and then thrown onto a fire."
Burtsev screwed up his face in disgust, and Dmitri felt sick to the pit of his stomach. He leaned on the piano so as not to collapse.
"Do you have a copy of the report?"
"I will bring it to your apartment tomorrow."
The report contained photographs of the items Sokolov had brought out of Russia in his infamous box. Dmitri knew about some of them from the 1919 press reports, but he pored over the images looking for a clue as to whether Tatiana's remains were in the mineshaft. There was the Tsar's belt buckle, a pearl earring of the type that Tsarina Alexandra always wore, some shoe buckles from the Grand Duchess's shoes, but not the type Tatiana had been wearing when last he saw her, Dmitri was sure of that. The eyeglasses and false teeth of the family's doctor, who had died with them, some icons, a jeweled badge, and that grotesque severed human finger. The body of a dog had been found at the bottom of the well, and Dmitri shuddered to think it could be Autipos. Rosa arrived while Dmitri and Burtsev were talking about the report, and began preparing a meal. Dmitri could tell she was straining to hear what was being said, but he did not include her in the conversation. It was nothing to do with her. Burtsev asked if Dmitri would write an article about the Sokolov report, and he agreed. He already knew what he would write, that without any bodies there could be no definitive proof the Romanovs were dead, that it was still possible the adults had been killed and the children imprisoned somewhere. News was beginning to filter out of Russia about the prison camps established by the Bolsheviks, horrific places where inmates were routinely beaten, starved, and tortured. He hoped Tatiana and her siblings were not being held in such a place, but that they were together, under house arrest in decent accommodation. When the government was overthrown and the exiles returned to their homeland, the Romanov children would be found and liberated. His article was published a few months later, and Rosa read it, but made no comment. One evening in November 1924, Dmitri and Rosa went to El Dorado nightclub with some Russian friends. While Rosa danced in her inimitable style, Dmitri chatted to his comrades about the Russian writers who were returning to the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, as it was now known, tempted back by overtures from the communist government. Alexei Tolstoy had just announced his departure for Moscow, Andrei Bailey had already returned, and Boris Pasternak, a supporter of the regime, had never left.
"I don't trust them," Dmitri said. "I love my homeland as much as any Russian, but I will not return until the Bolsheviks have been overthrown. The farcical trials and the inhuman prison camps demonstrate the true nature of their rule, and I think it is wrong for writers implicitly to condone these."
His friend agreed.
"Did you hear about the prison on the Solovki Islands? A favourite punishment there is mosquito torture, whereby they tie a man naked to a stake in the midst of a swarm. It is barbarian."
They were interrupted by a commotion on the dance floor, and when Dmitri stood to look,
he saw Rosa lying on the ground. He rushed over.
"What happened?"
he asked, kneeling beside her. Her eyes were closed, but he could hear her murmuring.
"She collapsed with no warning,"
someone said. The manager approached with two of the doormen.
"Let's take her to a back room where she can recover,"
he suggested. One of them lifted Rosa and carried her through a curtain to a room with a stained red velvet sofa and little else. She opened her eyes as she was laid on the sofa.
"Dimitri? Where am I?"
"In the club. You fainted,"
he told her, squeezing her hand.
"How are you feeling?"
"I'm all right. Just a little dizzy."
"Please, call a doctor," Dimitri instructed the manager. "I can pay."
While they waited for the doctor to arrive, Rosa rested with her eyes closed, and Dimitri looked around the room. He guessed this was where the female staff brought favoured customers for special treatment in return for generous tips. There was a nicotine-stained mirror on one wall, and a reproduction painting of naked shepherdesses on another. When the doctor arrived, he took Rosa's pulse, listened to her heart through his stethoscope, then asked her a string of questions in rapid German, which Dimitri could not follow. He prodded gently around her stomach and nodded to himself.
"What do you think it is?"
Dimitri asked. The doctor finished his examination before he replied.
"Your wife is pregnant, sir. Congratulations."
Rosa gasped and covered her mouth with her hand. Dimitri looked at her.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, I can feel the top of the uterus. In my opinion, the pregnancy is more than 12 weeks along."
Rosa still had a hand over her mouth, but Dimitri could see from her eyes that she was delighted, and he smiled reassurance at her, although he felt shell-shocked. His first reaction was panic. He couldn't have a child with Rosa. He would be tied to her then. Tatiana would be devastated if she found him and discovered he had a child with another woman. She might divorce him. But what could he do? He had no choice in the matter. Dimitri followed the doctor outside to pay him. As he counted the notes, the doctor said,
"Your wife should rest and eat well. No more nightclubs."
"She's not my wife. I'm already married, so it is rather a delicate situation."
The doctor gave him a sharp, unfriendly look.
"You've got yourself into rather a mess, sir. I hope you will behave with decency."
Shamefaced, Dimitri called a taxi to take Rosa home.
"Isn't it strange?"
she exclaimed as they sat in the back seat, Dimitri's arm around her.
"I had no idea. I thought I had put on a little weight, that's all. Do you think it might be a girl or a boy?"
Dimitri shrugged.
"No idea."
"I would prefer a boy, so he could grow up just like you."
She seemed nervous. She always talked too much when she was nervous.
"If the doctor is right about it being 12 weeks, then he will arrive in May next year. That would be lovely, just in time for the summer. You don't mind about this, do you, darling?"
"It's still a bit of a shock," he admitted.
"Yes, for me too. I didn't think we had taken any risks."
Dimitri usually withdrew when Rosa was in the fertile part of her monthly cycle.
"And I hadn't noticed that I'd missed my monthlies, but now it has happened. It will take some getting used to, but do you think you will be happy?"
"Give me a little time to get used to the idea," Dimitri said, but he gave her shoulders a reassuring squeeze.
"We'll need a bigger apartment," she continued.
"Not straight away, but our son will need a bedroom of his own."
Dimitri laughed.
"You are convinced he is a boy, even though you knew nothing of his existence until a couple of hours ago."
"Yes,"
she agreed.
"It's strange, but I am."
Back in the apartment, he helped her into bed, then climbed in beside her and switched off the light. In the darkness, Rosa asked timidly,
"Dimitri, could we please get married before the baby comes? It would mean so much, and my family will ask."
"I can't," he told her gently.
"I'm already married."
"Yes, to a ghost," she said sadly.
"How can I ever compete with that?"
Chapter 45. Berlin, 1925.
The baby was a healthy boy, with sandy blonde hair, blue eyes, and Russian bone structure. He looked remarkably similar to Dmitri's father.
What would